You know, when we first heard that sound in Australia, there were no rabbits at all. Ever since their introduction and their release into the bush, rabbits have caused, of course, incalculable damage, despite countless attempts to minimise the destruction caused by them to two-thirds of the continent. The wild bunny still holds the title of our worst vertebrate pest. In fact, researchers reckon that it takes less than one rabbit per hectare to prevent the successful regeneration of many of our common native trees and shrubs. And we've got thousands of the little buggers on the farm, despite every possible method of dealing with them. Now, shocking news. The damage done goes unnoticed because nobody today has ever seen a rabbit-free Australian environment. Bruce Munday, author of a new book called Those Wild Rabbits, been a farmer from the Adelaide Hills for 42 years, PhD in physics, 20 years experience as a communications consultant in agriculture and national resource management, and he joins us from the Melbourne TARDIS. Welcome.
Thank you, Philip.
I hadn't realised that the first bunnies came from Spain and Portugal. I had it in mind that they came straight from England.
No, they took some time to find their way to England, but there they did.
So Spain and Portugal is the source of the bunny?
It seems so. This goes way back, and of course it wasn't particularly well documented at the time, but the people who first came to Spain and Portugal saw plenty of rabbits and hunted by the imperial eagle, and that's largely what kept them in place in Spain.
So let's move on to 1859, when Thomas Austin notoriously released 24 common bunnies along with hares and pheasants and partridges. However, rabbits, you say, did arrive with the first fleet.
They did. They were brought out for pretty logical reasons. They were potentially food. And so the early colonists, when they came to Australia, brought not only other domestic livestock that we're familiar with now, but they also brought out rabbits. And why not? They'd been eating them in England. They should therefore expect to eat them when they came out to the colony.
So we can't put all the blame on Thomas Austin.
Well, we can't. If you sort of go back to the ones that came out with the first fleet and also subsequently, they weren't really wild rabbits. They were rabbits which were brought out in cages. They were essentially domesticated. And when they were released, then, of course, they fell prey to the natural predators, the quolls, our raptors and so forth. And it wasn't until Austin actually imported the wild rabbit from Scotland that the rabbit was given a fair chance. And of course, those wild rabbits were very well adapted to defending themselves and escaping predation. And Austin helped them along and not only Austin, he's not the only villain by any means, but Austin helped them along by annihilating a lot of the predators that would otherwise have controlled those populations.
When I go home late at night, my headlights sweep around the place and pick up any number of rabbits, but also hares. They're not as numerous, of course. They're rather more solitary creatures. But did Austin bring them as well?
He did. Not as successfully, in fact. The first lot of rabbits that came out, in fact, perished on the ship. But the second lot were much more successful. But similarly with the hares, they were okay as long as they had plenty of feed to give them on the boat. And one of the boats that a shipment of hares came out on lost a mast. The trip took quite a lot longer than expected, and unfortunately for the hares, they ran out of feed. But as you said, hares tend to be solitary. They don't have the same fecundity or same fertility as rabbits. So they were never going to be the same sort of potential problem for Australia as the rabbit was.
Now, many farmers today see the rabbit as a relatively minor irritant, but of course, after World War II, there are plenty around who can remember the decimation caused by the plagues before Mixo was released sometime in the 1950s. At its worst, how bad was our rabbit problem?
Well, it's very difficult to, how do you estimate the damage caused? As you mentioned, the damage to the environment is extraordinary. It's very hard to measure. The damage to agriculture was also extraordinary. The export of rabbits to Europe, either frozen or processed, was comparable to the export of lamb. So it was a major agricultural industry. So you can understand that there are an awful lot of rabbits. When we talk about the numbers of rabbits, of course, figures are bandied around 10 billion early in the 20th century. Now, I don't know how anyone ever calculated that 10 billion, because a lot of the time the rabbits is underground anyway, but they're very, very large numbers, and their ways of estimating them, they're absolutely huge. And a sort of a figure, these things, again, pretty hard to quantify, but the sort of figure that was often given around was that a rabbit could eat roughly a sixth of the amount of grass that a sheep could eat.
You know, when we moved to Elmswood, we inherited a lovely old bloke, Terry, who'd been the rabbito on the property, and it was his job to sort of minimise the destruction. But he did confess to us in his last years that he and many of his mates, in fact, were breeding rabbits up a bit. They were improving the quality of rabbits. They didn't want to see their livelihood destroyed.
Absolutely. There was a lot of conflict, actually, over the role of trappers. Now, a lot of people made a living out of trapping. Sometimes it was a fairly menial living, and others made a good living. But they were, as you point out, they're effectively farming rabbits, and they would go into an area where there's an abundance of rabbits, trap a large number of them, but then they moved on, partly because the population was diminishing and so they were becoming a little bit harder to get. But just as importantly, they wanted to leave alone plenty of breeding pairs so that when they came back in a few months' time, the rabbit population was reinstated. And so a lot of the pastoralists eventually got wise to this and said, this is never going to work. We need to get that last rabbit rather than keep leading those breeding pairs. And there was great conflict between the trappers and the pastoralists themselves.
And then along comes Mixo, and that had quite dramatic effects, pretty fast.
Yeah, we talk about the silver bullet, and that's really what Mixo was. The difference was huge. When you think that Mixo came in 1950, well, we'd had rabbits for about 90 years by then, and all the different techniques which we used, you know, trapping, fumigating, baiting, shooting, ripping warrens and so forth, had almost been to no avail. A huge number of rabbits had perished, but there were still as many rabbits because they just bred so prolifically. And it was only when Mixo, which was a communicable disease, could be passed through the rabbit population that a real impact was made. That was the enormous breakthrough.
I still see signs of Mixo from time to time, Bruce. We still find the odd rabbit who's got the telltale sign in the eyes. But you were listing all the other techniques before, like ripping. There was, you know, sending the ferrets down. There were so many other ways, weren't there, of attempting to cope.
That's right. And I think they were probably deluded to some extent. The fact that they were collecting such vast numbers of rabbits, you get a sense that you're making some progress in this, let's call it a war, but in fact they weren't really stopping the problem. And of course the irony is it was a war in which only one side was fighting. You know, the pastoralists, the farmers and so forth were trying to eradicate the rabbits when all the rabbit wanted to do was eat and breed. And so it was a very one-sided event. But, of course, with myxomatosis, then, of course, the impact was absolutely enormous. But it's also interesting, Philip, that you talk about rabbits on your farm. And, of course, for a long time, people around your way said the rabbit will never get here. It will never get across the divide. It will never get this far north and so forth. But they were always wrong. The rabbit always exceeded expectations.
What happened in New Zealand? Did they have the same problem as us?
They did, not at all unlike ours, but their approach was very different. You mentioned ferrets, and the New Zealanders took very much that approach of bringing in things like ferrets and stoats and weasels, the sort of things that would have preyed on rabbits back in the UK and other parts of Europe. And they naturalised far more effectively in New Zealand than they did in Australia, and it was to some extent climatic. But also they had a lot of other things that they could feed on. A lot of the little ground-dwelling birds in New Zealand then became prey for those animals. And it's not an unfamiliar story. Those predators which were brought in to control rabbits then became a problem of their own, and they are an enormous problem in New Zealand to this day.
I've suddenly got images of the Dust Bowl in the US and a creature called the jackrabbit in great numbers. Is that the same as our wild rabbit?
No, it's not. It's quite different. I think the name rabbit is probably not even appropriate to the jackrabbit. If you call that the lagomorph that we have here as a rabbit, then the one in the UK is the one in the US is not.
Okay, so it's just a different creature, but there are times when it seemed to be equally numerous. I've also can remember those incredible images filmed in Australia when the thing was at its worst pre-Mixo, when the rabbits were effectively mustered in huge numbers against fences.
They were. These were significant events where large groups of people would come together, including kids, and, as you described, muster the rabbits up against netted fences. And once they got them corralled, then they would hop into them waddies and so forth. And these were almost sort of sordid sporting events, and often they were used as fundraisers, not just to get rid of the rabbits, that was part of the objective, of course, but also it was a way of raising funds for the local footy club or whatever. Yeah, and it's quite tragic when you think back on it, of course. It really reflected, I think, the level of desperation that the landholders had. The rabbits were just in such plague proportions that the end justified the means, however cruel it might be.
And, of course, they had other problems. There was also, you know, the prickly pear phenomenon. It was pretty tough being a farmer at that during the post-war era.
It was indeed, yeah. And, of course, some of the other predators they brought in to control the rabbits, like the fox and the cat, became problems of their own. Not that foxes were brought in just to control rabbits, and likewise, but the idea of releasing cats, domestic cats, to control rabbits, that was quite widespread, and large numbers of cats were released across rural Australia.
And that has become a separate issue, hasn't it? That absolutely. In some areas, is out of a problem.
Absolutely. They don't just eat rabbits.
Yeah. Okay, and with dog baiting, there's a lot of that going on in the upper Hunter. That has the effect of also knocking off foxes, which then has a kick on, a domino effect in being and releasing the pressure on rabbits. It's so hard to get the balance right.
It is, and this is the whole point, Philip, that we tend to look at these things in isolation. The problem is the rabbit. It's the whole system, of course, which has to be looked at, you know, the role of predators and the prey. And even if you eliminate the prey, that is the rabbit, then what happens to those native predators, eels, hawks, quolls and so forth, that were dependent on rabbits, had become dependent on rabbits? And so, as you've quite rightly pointed out, it's a system that we need to deal with, not just a single animal.
I also have a sudden memory of the rabbito coming around selling rabbits door to door in Melbourne when I was a kid. Rabbits were good, cheap tucker.
They were. We were probably kids in Melbourne around about the same time, Philip, or I was down at Geelong. But I remember the rabbito. He would come round on a motorbike with a sidecar and he would call out, "Rabbito, rabbito." And Mum would go out there, and I think it was something like 1 and 6 a pair or something like that, and come in with the rabbits. And they were considered a real delicacy. You know,
they
this
sure
was shortly
were.
After the Second World
they
War.
Sure
yeah,
were.
Something to look forward to.
Yeah. Okay, now, Mixo. After the Mixo had this incredible impact, but rabbits started to develop immunity.
They did, but perhaps ironically, the immunity probably developed at a slower rate than it was predicted. When Mixo was first released in Australia in 1950, end of 1950, CSIRO was very cautious about how effective it would be. They felt that there was probably a 10-year window of opportunity, and the Mixo should be backed up with conventional control methods, particularly ripping warrens and so forth, to try and get rid of the last pair of rabbits.
Yes. Okay, so Mixo, however, starts to have a diminishing impact, and then along comes the Khaleesi virus. Now, that was the big miracle. I have never seen a sign of it in our neck of the woods, so that was partially successful.
Well, it was to complement Mixo. It was partly to overcome the issue that you raised, that animals do develop a resistance and also the virus itself becomes weaker. And so Khaleesi, or rabbit hemorrhagic disease, was really meant to be the second wave. It was to come in as a follow-up to Mixo. But it was also aimed at territory that wasn't covered by Mixo. The Mixo virus is spread by predominantly mosquitoes, and for that you need to have stagnant water.
Sure.
So if you go into the drier country, the pastoral lands and so forth, there was not much impact from Mixo because there weren't the vectors to carry it. And that was, to a large degree, the role of Khaleesi, to try and fill that gap. And it's been very successful at that, but it has not been so successful in the wetter areas, probably where you are, Philip. And that's why there's been interest in a new strain of the virus, which is known as K5, which was released quite recently. It appears to be better adapted to the wetter areas.
Anything coming down the turnpike? Anything new?
Well, K5 is it. It's called K5 because it's a strain that came from Korea. And the process, of course, when you're going to introduce a new biological control agent, it has to undergo a very long and extensive period of testing that it works on the rabbit and that it will not work on anything else. There will be no collateral damage, no off-target damage, and that needs to be done over a period of time to make sure that the virus is not mutating into something that you hadn't anticipated. So these things, we've learned our lessons, I guess, that these things need to be handled very, very carefully because, as you mentioned before, talking about the prickly pear, you can sometimes introduce these visitors from overseas and they become very, very dangerous.
Miraculously successful, the cactoglasses. That's right. Amazingly good, but then you get terrible mistakes like which end up with the cane toad.
Exactly.
We haven't had the time.
And many others.
We haven't had a time to talk about the history of legislation, but one of the things you reveal is for quite some time it was illegal in South Australia to shoot rabbits. Why?
There's a closed season. And the irony is that the closed season was basically the breeding season. When the rabbits were breeding, you weren't allowed to shoot them because that would have been detrimental to the overall population of rabbits. Because you've got to remember, when these were first introduced, there was great celebration. You know, Thomas Austin was seen as something of a hero because he'd brought some sport to Australia. And there's the very famous case of the then Duke of Edinburgh on a shooting party at Barwon Park, which was the station operated by Austin. And he had the time of his life shooting rabbits. And he congratulated Austin on introducing rabbits to Australia and providing sport for English gentlemen. And the same thing happened in South Australia. You know, they were seen as sport. And going out there and having a pot shot at a rabbit and taking home some tucker was pretty good.
I accepted that that absurd figure of, you know, X billion rabbits is probably a furphy. But has anyone actually calculated what they cost us now?
Well, there are figures. It's not so much what it's cost now. You've also got to anticipate what it might cost in the future if the rabbits keep on proliferating. And if you think about what's going to happen to myxomatosis, what's going to happen to RHD if they diminish in their efficacy, and if the rabbit itself becomes stronger against them, then of course they will return. But the damage to the pastoral industry is huge. But not only that,
got to go, Bruce. Sorry, mate. We're right out of time. Bruce Munday's book, Those Wild Rabbits, published by Wakefield Press.